Iran, saying that he should learn a lesson from the fate of the countries that relied on U.S. support. And Palestinian resistance groups vowed to respond to Israeli brutalities after regime forces killed yet another young Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The French satellite operator Eutelsat has taken the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting off the air. The operator says its move to cease its activities with the IRIB is under a European Union regulation passed earlier this month. The EU has imposed sanctions on dozens of Iranian individuals and several entities over the country's response to the recent riots. Eutelsat informed Tehran that it would remove Iranian channels, including English-language press TV, shortly after the ban was announced. Tehran has strongly condemned the decision, saying that the move further reveals the true colors of false advocates of freedom of expression and the free flow of information. Meanwhile, Europe continues to host TV channels which foment violence and terrorism in Iran. We have talked to university professor and political analyst Said Mohammad Morandi about Eutelsat's decision to remove the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting from its airwaves. He said that the move is aimed at preventing the voices of Iranian people from being heard across the globe.
The Europeans have sanctioned IRIB many times, and this was just the last of a series of sanctions that they've imposed. And the same is true with the United States. They've also imposed sanctions on IRIB. So the Europeans and the Americans have a long history of preventing Iranian voices from being heard in the West and also across the world, because their sanctions, their financial sanctions targeting Iranian radio and television, including sanctions that target ordinary businesses, the imports of medicine and medical supplies, among other things. All of these sanctions have a specific intention, not just to break Iranian society and kill people and hurt ordinary people, but also to silence the population. And it's not just Iran. Increasingly, the Europeans and Americans are sanctioning all voices that go beyond the boundaries of the official narrative. And we see that also through big tech, how people's accounts have been deleted. Millions of accounts have been deleted over the years, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
Iran's intelligence ministry says it has arrested four groups linked to the Israeli spy agency Mossad that were operating across the country. In a statement, the ministry said members of the groups were trying to carry out hybrid terror attacks across Iran using the recent riots in the country. The ministry said it has also got clues from the operative head of Mossad affiliates in a European country and will later announce the details. Recently, some Western countries have used the riots in Iran as a pretext to interfere in the country's affairs. Tehran says the West has instigated the riots and unrest, helping anti-Iran terror groups in a hypocritical way. Tehran has repeatedly rejected the West's criticism of its response to rioting, saying that any government is obliged to fight terrorism, violence, and hate speech. Tehran has condemned repeated accusations by the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of sales of Iranian drones to Russia to be used in the Ukraine war. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani reiterated that Iran has not provided drones to any side in the war in Ukraine. He said the Islamic Republic respects the sovereignty of all countries, including Ukraine. Kanani said that Zelensky needs to learn the lesson from the fate of countries that relied on the U.S. for support. The spokesman's remarks are in response to the Ukrainian president's speech in the U.S. Congress on Wednesday. Zelensky again accused Iran of sending drones to Russia in hundreds, threatening the country's critical infrastructure. Tehran dismisses the allegations, calling them part of Washington's propaganda campaign against Iran. Russia has accused the U.S. and Ukraine of turning a deaf ear to its concerns. This after the U.S. President Joe Biden announced further military assistance to Kiev in a meeting with his Ukrainian counterpart. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says neither Biden nor Volodymyr Zelensky have shown any signal that they are ready to listen to Russia's concerns. Peskov says this shows the U.S. is continuing its line of fighting an indirect war with Russia to the last Ukrainian. Biden, in a Wednesday meeting with Zelensky, announced nearly $1.8 billion in military supplies for Ukraine, including the Patriot missile defense system. Biden also claimed that Russia has no intention of ending the war. Officials in Moscow have repeatedly said that they have not ruled out talks with Ukraine, blaming Kiev for the closure of diplomatic channels. Washington correspondent Colin Campbell joined us earlier to tell us more about the new U.S. military aid package and Washington's pledge of long-term support for Ukraine.
This $2 billion is just an assistance package for the focus of this Patriot missile system that Zelensky has been asking for a while. But the U.S. is also poised to pass another $45 billion in aid. It's not 100% sure that it will be passed, but that's what's been pledged. And it'll be part of a nearly $2 trillion omnibus spending package by the Congress. So this is not just the last in aid, this nearly $2 billion, not quite a $2 billion, but nearly $2 billion that the that Ukraine will actually receive from the U.S., but it's just part of billions, another tens of billions of dollars coming from the U.S. As he pledged more aid, Zelensky thanking American families, Americans themselves, politicians, really in some ways ingratiating himself to America because he knows that he will depend on them if he needs military support in the future. Not only that, we do have a change in Congress coming up in mid-January when all of the new politicians will have been sworn in after winning their elections. And that's a little, the makeup of Congress will be a little bit different. Instead of having the Democrats run the House and the Senate, the Republicans will be the ones in charge of the House. Democrats held on to the Senate in this past election. So that means that Zelensky will have to appeal to Republicans this time if he expects to get continued aid. There's already some skepticism coming from conservatives and Republicans on how much the U.S. is spending in Ukraine.
An investigation based on Twitter's internal files has revealed that the social media platform helped the U.S. military amplify its online propaganda campaigns about its activities in West Asia. The probe says that Twitter granted Pentagon-affiliated accounts more visibility, even allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. At the top of the campaign's agenda was spreading criticism of Iran and showing support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
An investigation has shed light on the complicity of social media giant Twitter in the propaganda of the U.S. military in the West Asia region. The investigation says Twitter helped the U.S. military amplify its propaganda campaigns in this region, allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. The probe has been carried out by a journalist and is based on internal documents released by Elon Musk, who took over as Twitter's CEO in October. Musk has released the documents as an effort to boost transparency about the social media platform's operations under the previous management. The investigation says Twitter secretly created a special whitelist exempting accounts run by U.S. Central Command or CENTCOM for spam and abuse flags. The move allowed those accounts greater visibility on the platform. It says Twitter quietly introduced the feature in 2017. The measure was introduced after U.S. military officials asked the company to improve the visibility of Arab language accounts used to amplify certain messages. Those included promoting U.S. military narratives, anti-Iran messages, and support for the U.S. and Saudi-backed war in Yemen. According to the report, CENTCOM concealed its ownership of the accounts. In some cases, it used fake pictures and bios to give them the impression that they were run by civilians in the region. The social media giant tolerated the presence of the accounts on the platform until at least May 2022.
The investigation says the collusion between Twitter and the U.S. military continued until at least May of this year. Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda campaigns. For example, in the year 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia. But these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military.
Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda efforts. For example, in 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia's propaganda efforts. but these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military efforts. The finding of this research appeared to corroborate a major report published in August by online security researchers affiliated with the Stanford Internet Observatory. That report claimed that thousands of accounts that they suspected to be part of a state-backed information operation. It said many of those accounts used photorealistic human faces generated by artificial intelligence and were connected with an online ecosystem that included fake news websites, meme accounts on Telegram and Facebook, and online personalities. They all echoed Pentagon messages and included anti-Iran messages. Some of them accused Iran of threatening Iraq's water security. Others promoted allegations that Iran was harvesting the organs of Afghan refugees. In the summer of 2020, officials from Facebook reportedly identified fake accounts attributed to CENTCOM's influence operation on its platform. Reports show in 2020, Facebook and Twitter executives were invited by the Pentagon's top attorneys to attend classified briefings in a sensitive, compartmented information facility. The result of that meeting was that many of the fake accounts remained active for at least another year. Some of the accounts on the CENTCOM list remain active even now.
The cost of living crisis, coupled with rising inflation, is taking a heavy toll on Britain's economy. New official data shows the country's economy contracted in the third quarter more than it was estimated. According to the Office for National Statistics, GDP dropped 0.3% in the July to September period, up 0.1% estimated previously. The fall in manufacturing and production has been blamed for the contraction. Figures also show the country is lagging further behind other advanced economies. It comes as Britain is already teetering on the brink of a recession amid sky-high inflation that rose at the fastest rate in 40 years in May. A wave of strikes across the country since the summer has also impacted growth. People are fed up with the government's failure to raise their wages to keep pace with inflation. Israeli forces have killed a young Palestinian during a raid on the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. The new fatality increases the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the beginning of the current year to 224. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the Israeli killing of a young Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. Hamas paid homage to 23-year-old Ahmed Atef Mustafa Darahema, who lost his life during an Israeli raid on the city of Nablus. The movement also praised the Palestinians for their resistance against the occupying regime in the occupied territories. Hamas said the blood of martyrs will not go in vain and will only serve as a catalyst for further resistance. Separately, the Islamic Jihad movement has warned that Israel's continued crimes and terrorist activities would not provide security to the regime. It has vowed to respond to Israeli brutalities. The new fatality increases the number of Palestinians killed this year by Israeli forces to 224, including 53 in the besieged Gaza Strip. Our correspondent Ramallah Mona Kandil joined us earlier to tell us more about what exactly unfolded during Israel's latest raid on the occupied city of Nablus.
The raid this night was to the eastern part of the Nablus city, where dozens of Israeli Jewish settlers raided Joseph's tomb, in Arabic, the Yusuf, Qabr Yusuf in Nablus, escorted, of course, by Israeli forces. This tomb is located inside Area A, under full Palestinian control. And the Israeli settlers, the Israeli forces are prohibited from raiding the area. Despite this, every month, at least twice, Israeli settlers raid the area because they consider it's a holy site for them. Clashes erupted between Palestinian fighters and the Israeli soldiers. At the end of the day, Palestinians receive nothing from the international community but statements of condemnation and let's say calls, just calls to the Israeli regime to stop their crimes committed against the Palestinians and the illegal policies practiced as well. But at the end of the day, the Israeli regime know very well that these condemnations would not turn into sanctions or acts against it. That's why they continue their aggression.
The UN Security Council has adopted the first ever resolution on Myanmar that calls on the military junta to release all political prisoners, including Aung San Suu Kyi. The 15-member council adopted the draft with 12 votes in favor and 3 abstentions, including China, Russia, and India. The resolution also demands an immediate end to all forms of violence and urges all parties to respect human rights, fundamental freedoms, and the rule of law. Earlier attempts to adopt a resolution on Myanmar failed due to divisions among council members. The Myanmar's military seized power in February of last year over alleged voter fraud during the 2020 elections. It suspended the government of then de facto ruler Suu Kyi, arrested her, and unleashed a widespread crackdown on pro-democracy protests. Later, a junta court sentenced Suu Kyi to 26 years in prison on different charges, including corruption. The head of the World Health Organization expresses great concern over a spike in COVID infections in China, as projections suggest the country could face an explosion of cases and deaths next year.
WHO is very concerned over the evolving situation in China, with increasing reports of severe disease. In order to make a comprehensive risk assessment of the situation on the ground, WHO needs more detailed information on disease severity, hospital admissions, and requirements for ICU support.
Gabriel also urged China to focus its efforts on vaccinating people at the highest risk, saying the UN Health Agency would support Beijing in the process. The unprecedented COVID surge has overwhelmed hospitals across China. A hospital and commercial hub, Shanghai, has told its staff to prepare for a tragic battle as half of the city's population is expected to get infected by the year end. China's zero COVID approach had kept infections and deaths comparatively low. Cases spiked after the government's sudden decision to lift lockdowns, quarantines, and mass testing. Officially, there have been 5,241 COVID-related deaths in China since the start of the pandemic. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
U.S. authorities have claimed the war in Ukraine will continue for as long as they want and they will provide military assistance to Ukraine. But many experts are saying America's arsenals of weapons and munitions are running low. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website of Foreign Policy writes, as the conflict in Ukraine shows little sign of abating, Kiev's Western partners are grappling with how to maintain a supply of arms and ammunition to Ukraine without letting their stockpiles dwindle to the point that it could jeopardize their own readiness levels. A NATO official who spoke on condition of anonymity said, "I think everyone is now sufficiently worried," adding, "The Allies had called on Western defense contractors to ramp up production in the wake of the conflict in Ukraine. The relevance of stockpiling is back." The official said NATO is now discussing how to support member states if their stockpiles fall below the levels needed to meet their war obligations under the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Although decisions around military aid to Ukraine fall to individual members of the alliance, NATO Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg has repeatedly spoken about the need for continued armed delivery to Ukraine. Jeb Nadana, a former U.S. Supply Assistant Secretary of Defense for Industrial Policy during the Trump administration, said, "Even if there wasn't the Ukrainian fight, our stockpiles are still too low. You don't have to invent the weapons of the 22nd century to do this. But the industry will need a stable demand signal." Behind the scenes, the United States and other NATO countries have urged Western defense companies to bump up production. However, current and former officials and analysts said defense contractors have been slow to respond as they wait for assurances that the era of an increased arms appetite is here to stay. Mark Kansian, who served as chief of Pentagon's Force Structure and Investment Division until 2015, said, "What they say is essentially show me the money. Their fear is that the war will end and the orders will end and they will end up with these expanded factories that don't have any orders to fill them. Contributing to bottlenecks in production are rising prices of critical raw materials and a shortage of skilled labor." In mainland Europe, where military aid to Ukraine is being dwarfed by the United States and some countries, such as Germany, are still reluctant to dust off old tanks to send to Ukraine. Leaders do not want a mobilization that would put the defense industry back on a seemingly war footing. And skilled workers, high school trained technicians, designers, and safety and environmental experts are often reluctant to bring their talents to the defense industry, fearing that they could be first on the chopping block in any downturn. In an all-out artillery war with the Russians that has lasted almost since the Kremlin declared its operation in the Donbas region in April, Ukraine has practically run itself out of Soviet standard artillery, which comprises about 60% of their arsenal, forcing Kiev to rely more heavily on NATO standard artillery that can't be produced fast enough to sustain the fight. CNN has also covered the same story. Concern is growing in the U.S. government about its ability to keep supplying Ukraine with state-of-the-art systems and ammunition amid its ongoing conflict with Russia. According to three U.S. officials interviewed by CNN, Some of the challenges the U.S. is facing in terms of supporting Ukraine include its dwindling stockpiles of arms and the ability of the defense industry to cope with demand. One official told CNN that there is a finite amount of excess stock that Washington can send to Kiev. The report says Washington is particularly concerned about the available stockpiles of 155mm artillery shells and Stinger air defense missiles. Some officials are also worried about the production of arms such as HARMS anti-radiation missiles, GMLRS surface-to-surface missiles, and Javelin anti-tank systems. However, CNN source maintains that the dent in the stockpiles does not compromise national security, given that the weapons for Ukraine do not come from the supplies the Pentagon reserves for its own contingencies. A senior official also told CNN that the assessment that the United States is running low on arms is subjective, as it depends on how much risk the Pentagon is prepared to accept. Officials say one of the major concerns is that the U.S. defense industry is struggling to keep up with demand, while European countries cannot fully backfill their own stockpiles to replace the military hardware already sent to Ukraine. Since the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine in last February, the United States and its Western allies have been providing Kiev with billions of dollars in security assistance, with Moscow repeatedly warning that the weapons shipments to Kiev would only prolong the conflict. According to the Pentagon, as of early November, Washington has committed to sending Kiev over 1,400 Stinger missiles, 8,500 Javelin missiles, 142 155mm howitzers, and up to 903,155mm artillery rounds. The website Politico has also covered the same story. A much-touted European Union fund meant to help countries replace weapons shipped to Ukraine is increasingly unable to cover an influx of reimbursement requests, and it hasn't even sent out its first payment yet. Days after Russia's special operation began, the European Union set up a 500 million euro pot, encouraging countries to arm Kiev and ask the European Union to foot the bill. According to estimates shared by three diplomats, after looking at the receipts that it has received, Brussels determined it could cover about 85% of the costs. Then the European Union authorized an even bigger pot, eventually totaling 1.5 billion euros. The estimates showed the European Union got so many requests that it calculated Brussels could only cover roughly 46% of the requests. According to the diplomats, the plummeting percentage angered Poland, one of the EU's largest weapons donors to Ukraine, and a leading reimbursement seeker, having submitted 1.8 billion euros in receipts. For days, the country blocked a final agreement on disbursing the second tranche of money, hoping to negotiate a higher rate. One diplomat noted, for them, below 50% is just too little. But according to diplomats, Warsaw ultimately relented, agreeing recently to the 46% figure. The move came as frustration mounted among other member countries of the European Union, who saw Poland as standing between them and large EU payments. Still, the waning payback scheme risked damaging the EU's reputation as a reliable military partner, just as Ukraine implores Europe for more weapons for the conflict with Russia. Already, European Union powers, Germany and France, are facing criticism for not donating enough weaponry and ammunition, while some smaller countries say they're running low on supplies.
Forbidden Files.
Acres and a mule. That's right, 40 acres and a mule. After 246 years of slavery, that is what African Americans who had been enslaved were promised by the U.S. government. Well, that was back in 1865, and although that was no real compensation for 2.5 centuries of slavery, even that promise was not kept towards Black Americans. It became symbolic of all the other promises, laws, programs that were supposed to bring about more economic parity with whites for Black Americans, but never took place. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Today, we're going to take you on a journey that started centuries ago on the African continent and yet still has proportional consequences on millions of African Americans today. Estimates vary from $6 trillion to $60 trillion, the value of those 40 acres and a mule today. Well, the wealth never paid to the former slaves nor their descendants. The generational wealth that was never passed down, that opportunity, like so many others, that was never provided to blacks, while endless opportunities, grants, raises, stipends, etc., were given to white Americans. The results show a staggering difference between black and white wealth, even in America today.
In 2019, the median white household was worth $188,200. The median black household held $24,100 in wealth. White households had 7.8 times more wealth than blacks. In 2020, whites made up 60% of the U.S. population, but held 84% of the total household wealth. Black households, who constituted 13.4% of the U.S. population, held 4% of the total household wealth. White households inherit over 5.3 times more than black households. And white households are 2.8 times more likely than black households to inherit any wealth.
Well, we're going to dig into this issue further with our first guest, Cam Howard.
Cam Howard is a reparations expert who has been fighting for decades to get reparations for black Americans. He has addressed the United Nations and has traveled the world presenting the case for reparations for African Americans. He's an administrator for NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Thanks so much for being with us. Do you think that black Americans should get reparations, and if so, why?
So I certainly believe that blacks in this country should get reparations. And it's primarily because of, you know, two reasons. One, there's never been justice and fairness in any large measure for African-Americans, people of African descent in this country. As you know, we came here as stolen, kidnapped people from the continent of Africa to slave in the cotton fields and tobacco fields and rice fields in America, and then later in some of the factories during the industrial age. The tremendous amount of crimes were committed against us during the period of enslavement. But then after the period of enslavement, we had a brief period called Reconstruction in this country where there was some semblance of fairness and justice. Then that was followed by another 80 plus years of terroristic apartheid by white supremacist organizations in this country that removed, again, all notions of fairness and justice in the areas of education, in areas of economics, in the area of labor, employment, et cetera. There was criminal punishment, criminal justice. There's been no fairness. There was no fairness. It was an apartheid system backed by the terror of the state. And then after the Jim Crow period, apartheid period in this country, in 1965 and their 60s, as a result of the civil rights movement, we had a small window of fairness and justice with the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the Voting Rights Act that was passed. And then in the 70s, we had a semblance of fairness with affirmative action. But all those things have been stripped down, taken away the teeth of what should have been given to us in the area of fairness and justice, they've been watered down. So when you look at the police violence in our communities, it's still a continuation of the non-fair and non-just treatment that we receive in this country. So, you know, only a very brief periods in this country of African Americans ever received the type of fair and just treatment that immigrants and people who are, you know, other Americans or people who just come to America, they receive just by being within these boundaries. But African Americans as a whole, we have not shared any type of governmental fairness and justice for the long haul. Secondly, reparations are due because of the tremendous injury that we still suffer from today as a result of these hundreds of years, centuries of mistreatment in this country. When you look at every area of people of activity in this country, Blacks on the bottom of every good list and on the top of every bad list, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's criminal punishment, whether it's wealth, whether it's, you know, health, maternal mortality, infant mortality, all these things, you see a stark difference between Black lived experience and white lived experience in this country.
Well, what type of reparations are you proposing?
We look at reparations in the forms of, from the international law standpoint, of gross crimes committed by a state against the civilian population, where that tends to lay out what is known as full reparations. And there's five basic components. First component is cessation and guarantees of non-repetition. First, you must stop the bad acts. You must eliminate the policy that disproportionately negatively affect people of African descent in this country. That's first and foremost, the criminal justice laws, the housing laws, the economic laws that exist, the disproportionate resource allocation toward education and other aspects of our community. First, you must cease those policies and then put in place structures that ensure that those policies don't show up again. Like when enslavement ended, enslavement resurfaced for another 45 years in the form of convict leasing, in the form of sharecropping, in the form of debt peonage, where, you know, that we still existed in enslavement, but it was not called enslavement. So we need to stop these bad policies that exist today and make sure that we put in structures that they don't resurface. The second component of full reparations is restitution. How do you return the people back to where they would have been had these crimes not committed? So we're talking centuries of crime. So there's going to be multiple generations of repair that's necessary in the areas of education, in the areas of economic development and wealth building and employment and these type of areas and land acquisition and housing. All these areas have to be addressed and redressed with targeted resources. The third component is compensation. When restitution doesn't alleviate a situation, the compensation is an obligatory form of reparations under international norms. And we certainly know that in order for us to have some type of parity and wealth in this country, there's going to have to be some type of direct compensation. We don't know what that be and how much it would be, but certainly we are fighting for that because it is, again, obligatory under international law to redress the situation in its entirety. The fourth component of full reparations is satisfaction. How do you return the dignity back to a people whose dignity was eroded as a result of the crimes you committed against them? Sometimes an apology will do that. Other times, you know, museums, markers, removing a statuary, creating monuments, new monuments, curriculum overhaul, truth and reconciliation commissions, those type of things lend to dignity. Return or satisfaction. And then the fifth component is rehabilitation for the mind, heart, and spirit damage to the people as a result of the crimes. Black people in America have the worst health profile among any people. Our health profile is similar to those in quote-unquote third world countries in certain areas. Highest rates of cancer, highest rate of heart attack, highest rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality, as I stated, highest rates of breast cancers among women, the highest rates of testicular cancer or prostate cancer among men. I mean, the health profile is terrible. And we know now through transgeneration epigenetic inheritance that health profile is a result of the historical trauma we've experienced as a people in this country.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Cam Howard. We're going to take a look at a few instances that have taken place over the years and why African Americans are demanding reparations. You know, slavery launched modern capitalism and actually turned the United States into the wealthiest country in the world. Looking at this cotton production, I mean, by the 1830s, 77% of U.S. cotton was used for the British textile industry. And look at that, 2.25 billion pounds of cotton in 1859. And you know, the cotton actually built New York City as a commercial and financial center. And if you look at the whole worth after the outbreak of the Civil War and the values of slaves, $3 billion, 48% of total wealth in the South in 1860. So very valuable commodity. The emancipation, though, of African Americans did not bring about any type of economic freedom. There were continual policies to make sure that they never got their rights, starting off, of course, with not getting the 40 acres and a mule. However, the slave owners in the South, they actually got compensation after the Civil War, $300 per slave loss or freed. And throughout the time, the safety nets for other Americans was never in place for African Americans, not the loans, not the access to affordable housing in good neighborhoods. There was redlining to prevent them. And even when they could take off a little and be successful in some type of business, as we see like Black Wall Street, then there were efforts to totally eliminate and annihilate any type of success that they had. I mean, this is just a very, very small example of some of the reasons why African Americans are demanding reparations.
Kalonji Jamachanga currently serves as co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute and is co-founder of Black Power Media. He has fought on multiple fronts, tackling issues from local and national police brutality cases to international human rights violations. Under Kalonji's direction as founder and national coordinator of the FTP movement, programs such as International Feed the People and the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism have matured and developed. He has shared his experiences in the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Kalonji Jamachanga. What's your perspective in general regarding reparations?
You know, when I think of reparations, you know, most people think reparations is money. That's not what we're talking about. Our first order of operation is our political prisoners, because like any other civilized nation, whenever there is war or there's any type of, fighting or what have you, any type of disagreements, the first thing before anything can go down is they want their captives back. You know what I mean? So we want our political prisoners back first and foremost. And it is my belief that if we are, the question around reparations should also include the continent of Africa. I think that, the first thing should be, they should be paying reparations to folks on the continent because they stole not only the land, not only the minerals and the wealth, they stole us, they stole humans, you know? So, we totally believe that reparations should be paid, but will it be paid? We don't believe this country is capable of that type of accountability or respect for us as a whole.
What type of reparations in general do you think would be necessary?
You know, land is definitely, you know, is necessary. You know, we're not just talking about some cash, because we know that the U.S. dollar doesn't mean anything. And we know that if they gave us reparations with cash, then they'll just raise the prices up. They'll hike the prices up. You know, so, you know, that's a foolish notion that all we want is money. You know, we know that the American dollar has no real value across the globe. They place their own value on it. You know, so we don't want anything that they can take away. What we'd really like you said, is to be left alone. What we really like is to folks to say, you know what, we want to return these goods. We want to make good with our people. But we know that under a capitalist society, we know that capitalism is a violent system. You cannot have capitalism without the pain and suffering of others. They package it well. They make you feel comfortable and make you feel like, you know, yes, you should be a part of the capitalist system and you should grow and, you know, everything's going to be all right. But it's not the case. They let a few, quote unquote, African-Americans and a few so-called minorities, or should we say other oppressed people, give them the illusion of power. And, you know, power is about self-determination. So if you don't have self-determination and you don't have a place of your own and you don't have your own tongue and your own culture, then again, you are a displaced person. You are a person that's running around trying to find themselves. And that is how they have us right now. So we're talking about 500 years of this practice of terrorism. So we must understand that, unfortunately, in this country in particular, when you are, you know, their success has to equal your failure. Someone has to be at the bottom and someone has to be at the top. And in the capitalist system, the folks at the bottom will always get stepped on in order to benefit those who are at the top, the oppressors.
In your perspective, what are some of the systemic efforts that have taken place in order to prevent African Americans from achieving equality?
The whole notion of equality is a myth, because we were brought here as chattel slaves, as surplus labor. We were brought here as, you know, as treated like domesticated animals, you know. So they looked at us as property. They never looked at us as equal, you know. Even on paper, they said we were 3/5 of human beings. They didn't even consider us a human being. Matter of fact, the quote unquote forefathers of this country, they treated us like objects, you know. Even when you talk about folks like George Washington, these are, you know, most of the men who happen to be on the money here, the dollar bills and the cash and the coins, these are former slave masters. You know, these are folks who gave away Africans, and we don't consider ourselves slaves. We were enslaved, because we weren't slaves when we encountered these folks. So we were enslaved Africans. So these are folks who literally gave us away. George Washington's wife gave Africans away for wedding gifts. They gave us away like we were poodles, or like we were some type of plants, or some type of exotic horse. You know what I'm saying? Like we were camels. We were treated as nothing more than, like I said, domesticated animals. Like we were tricks. We performed for these people. We worked for these people. We built for these people. And in turn, we were enslaved, we were tortured, and to this very day, we are victims of a systematic oppression, which, again, stems from capitalism and global white supremacy. This is what it's all about. You know, capitalism and enslavement are Siamese twins.
We're just about out of time, Mr. Changa, but do you have any final thoughts?
I would like to say that people of the world, oppressed people, quote unquote, third world people, we have to resist imperialism at every turn. We have to, like it says in Islam, we have to change things with our hands. And if we can't change it with our hands, we have to speak out against it. And if we don't speak out against it, then we at least have to hate it in our hearts. We have to remember that we are here for a limited time, and we have the right to exist. We have the right to love. We have the right to be. our natural selves. And no man, woman, or child should be able to exploit, dominate, or oppress us.
Very powerful words. Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. From 1619, when the first Africans were enslaved in what would become the United States, until the present, Africans and their descendants in that country have never been considered as equals with their white counterparts. They have been the victims of systemic terrorism as they have built that country, and now they are demanding their fair share of it. Will they get reparations? Will their demands be met? Not likely, but we will continue to follow their story, their cases, and their demands for justice. And we'll bring you all the latest on that right here at Hidden Files. And make sure you join me and the team right here next week as we dig into another Hidden File. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
French satellite operator Eutelsat suspends its services to Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting days after it took Press TV off the air. Iran hits out at the Ukrainian president's remarks against Tehran, saying that he should learn a lesson from the fate of the countries that relied on U.S. support. And Palestinian resistance groups vow to respond to Israeli brutalities after regime forces killed yet another young Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank.